So today is a little bit of a special day in the sense that yesterday one of the very few true Zen masters, I believe, that exists in this world has passed away. Thich Nhat Hanh. Yeah, he passed away. And he's 95 years old. He was 95 years old. He had a stroke quite a few years ago, and that has resulted in him not being able to speak for some years. But I'll talk a little bit more about that towards the end of this Teisho. So I've got a little addendum on this sheet of paper about something about him. So I'll talk about that later on. So today we will be looking at Shoyoroku, case number 5, which is also the Book of Equanimity. Saigen's Price of Rice. That's the koan. So I'll just read out the introduction. Scheidei cut off his flesh to feed his parents, but he could not be enrolled in the traditional list of filial children. Devadatta pushed a mountain to crush the Buddha, yet did he ever fear the peals of abrupt thunder? Pass through the jungle of thorns, chop down the forest of sandalwood, and wait till the year comes to an end. As of old, early spring is still chilly. Where is the Dharma body of the Buddha at all? And then the case. A monk asked Saigen, "What is the essence of Buddha's Dharma?" Saigen said, "What is the price of rice in Roryo?" Then the verse. The rain of great peace knows no form. The atmosphere of the rugged old man is superbly pristine. There is nothing but singing and drinking in the village festival. How could they be aware of the virtues of Shun and the goodwill of Gyo? So here we have today's case, Book of Equanimity. As you know, the Book of Equanimity is the number 3 book in our curriculum. The first book is the miscellaneous koans, or other miscellaneous koans, assembled by Harada Roshi in our lineage. The second book is Mumon Khan, so that's where Mu comes from, by Mumon. And he both wrote the verse and the commentary on that. Then the third book is the third book in our lineage is the Blue Cliff Record. Zetsho assembled that, and Engo some 100 years later wrote the commentary. Zetsho also wrote the words, and here we've got the Book of Equanimity, fourth book, and that was assembled by Master Wanchi, and the commentary later was, or the commentary later was written by Master Bansho. Then there's after that there's the one more book to go, a big book to go, which is the A Transmission of Light, the Denko Roku by Master Kaizen, and then there's the Goi, which is the 5 ranks of Tozen. So that's just a just to let you know that how many books that we've got, in case you've forgotten about this. So here we have Book of Equanimity number 5. This is quite a tricky koan, not an easy koan to see by all means. It might seem very simple, and the way I explain it might seem very simple, might be difficult too. But generally, it is not that easy to see, like all koans. And for us, of course, it's always a matter of entering that world of the koan, if you like, entering that world that is somehow portrayed in the koan, and that's our task, of course, to enter into and engage with. So we'll start off with the introduction. Scheidei cut off his flesh to feed his parents, but he could not be enrolled in the traditional list of filial children. So what's this about? Scheidei is an old prince. It appears in some sutra. I'm not sure which sutra it is. And the story goes that he left, for whatever reason, his home, and maybe because of political pressure or whatever, he took his parents with him, and on the road they were starving. So he cut off his own flesh to feed his parents so that they could all stay alive. That's the story, basically the story. But then it says he could not be enrolled in the traditional list of filial children. So there must have been, you remember in China, filial piety is a big thing. Looking after your parents is like number one rule. And so there must have been a list, an honors list, an honors roll. Like we have honor roll, Australia Day coming up. We have our Australia Day honor roll. And there must have been an honor roll in those days of filial children. Those that really made an effort to look after their parents. And here in this introduction, it says that he cut off the flesh to feed his parents. And I don't think you can go, you can be more filial than that, you know. And yet, he did not make the list. So the question to ask ourselves, first of all, remembering this is a Kohen. So this is, you know, this a Kohen is not to be viewed from our ordinary discriminating way of thinking. So why is a question that would come up. Why did he not make it onto that list? So it's a barrier. A barrier has been thrown up there straight away. Why did he not make it to that list? Okay. And of course, in order to answer that question, we need to enter that world of non-duality again. In that we need to somehow look at that from that perspective. Otherwise, we will not get an answer. So that's the first challenge here. So that's what Bancho is saying here. So then he goes on to say, Devadatta. And remember, this introduction points to the koan. It always points to the koan. Introduction points to the main koan. So the next line in the introduction says, Devadatta, who was the cousin of the Buddha. Okay, Devadatta was the cousin of the Buddha. He pushed a mountain to crush the Buddha. Yet did he ever fear the peals of abrupt thunder? So quite often in the Pali canon, we read a little bit about Devadatta. And he, by all accounts, was very jealous of the Buddha. And quite often he wanted to somehow break up the Sangha and start a rival Sangha. Okay, so when you look at the history of Buddhism and you look at the stories that have been told there, that comes up in a few instances. And by all accounts, he wanted to kill the Buddha. And he had a demon or whatever you want to call it, dislodge a bull, so the story goes, a boulder, so that, you know, when the Buddha apparently walked down the hill, that boulder was supposed to have crushed the Buddha, you know. And the story goes that a deity came and actually pushed the boulder away just before it fell down, before where the Buddha was walking. And the boulder split into many parts. But a little piece of rock still hit the Buddha's foot and made bleed. And that is a mortal sin in Buddhism. Like when we look at Buddhist cosmology again and the traditional Buddhist stories, there, you know, you are not supposed to harm a Buddha. And if you do, then you go to eternal hell. Okay. And so this is what this refers to. That Devadatta pushed a mountain, big boulder, to crush the Buddha. Yet did he ever fear the peals of abrupt thunder? So the story goes that the Buddha felt sorry for him and went to hell to look him up. Or he sent someone to go to hell to look him up. And Devadatta is supposed to have said, I am not in hell. I'm actually experiencing the third jhana, the third state of, you know, just before enlightenment, that third state of awakening or that third state of concentration, the third jhana. Jhana means meditative absorption. So this is what he's supposed to have said. So this is a very interesting story. Again, we might say from our own perspective, if he did a mortal sin, you know, and he's in hell, how can he be, you know, accessing the third jhana? Okay. But here, of course, it says, the question that we are asked, did he ever fear the peals of abrupt thunder? Again, in that world that we are looking at from a Buddhist point of view, or that we are looking at from a Zen point of view, you know, the question is there such a thing as hell? Is there such a thing as heaven? So we need to answer that question for ourselves, of course. So as we know, I think it was Shakespeare in Hamlet where it says there is neither good or bad, but thinking makes it so. In fact, James mentioned it entered the Zendo, when we were setting up the Zendo, we were talking about that. So that world of non-duality transcends good and bad. You know, so this is what this is referring to, and of course it's inviting us to see that through this koan. The challenge here is actually quite significant, and I think sometimes we don't realize it, that we hear these stories and we go, oh yeah, you know. But this is about us right now too. Like even those people that have had the opportunity to have a Kensho experience, you know, can you really say it? Can you really say that it transcends evil? Or that world that you have seen, that you've made it to the point where you are transcending that, where you can really say, yes, I have transcended that. You know, that doesn't mean to say that we can't engage in a conversation or that we can't see and call out evil in this world, you know. But is how to what degree is our peace affected? To what degree am I affected by it? You know, or am I caught up so much in that world that is the only thing I see, the good and the bad? Or can I say that I have really, truly transcended it? And when I was thinking about this, I thought of COVID again. You know, COVID is a very, you know, it's a very fearful thing. You know, and of course we get bombarded with all these news stories about COVID and hospitalizations and ICUs and what's happening all around the world. And that doesn't mean to say that we ignore that once we've had a Kensho experience or once we have transcended that good and evil. But at the same time, to what degree am I really at peace with COVID? You know, that is a challenge for all of us. And that is, in a way, not just a challenge, but an indicator of where we are at in our practice. Where am I in my practice? To what degree can I say I have transcended that or not? Is an important question. And again, this is what this introduction is pointing at. You know, so it's not just Devadatta, it's about us. You know, to what degree have we transcended it? Okay. Then it goes on to say, pass through the jungle of thorns. So the jungle of thorns, pass through that jungle of thorns, beautiful way of saying it. Pass through all of those delusions of right and wrong, of hell and heaven, pass through all of those. That's the challenge here. Pass through all of those delusions, you know, when Zuckerberg of Facebook announced that he was creating the metaverse, I tried to get my head around that, thinking, what is the metaverse? You know. But in a way, you know, we are living in our own metaverse already. You know, we have already created a metaverse in our head. We all live in our own story. And Zuckerberg and all these other high-tech companies, they are taking advantage of that. They are augmenting that. in many ways. It is so hard to find out, and of course that is what the Jet's End journey is about. It is so hard to find out what is real, what is fact, because we are already overlaying that with so many concepts and with so many ideas that it is really difficult. And so this is the challenge here. Pass through the jungle of thorns, and it is going to be made even more difficult for that next generation that is going to inhabit the metaverse, this virtual reality, you know. So this is quite interesting to see how that evolves. Of course, in a way, this is it as well, you know. But to what degree can we really see that? And to what degree can we be clear about that? That remains the question. Chop down, it goes on to say, chop down the forest of sandalwood and wait till the year comes to an end. Chop down the forest of sandalwood, a lovely way of saying, get rid of the brambles, cut down the illusions. You know, what is our forest of sandalwood? What is our forest of sandalwood? That's the question that we ask ourselves. So if I ask you the question, what's your problem? What's your problem? And really think about that at the moment. Like right now, we all have problems. You know, we might have health problems, we might have financial problems, we might have mortgage problems with financial, I guess that falls into the category of financial problems. We might have relationship problems. Just think about it. What is our problem? And really what it comes down to, cut down the brambles. That's the way it was, wasn't it? Cut down, chop down the forest of sandalwood. Chop down the forest of sandalwood. In our practice, you know, chopping down the forest of sandalwood is nothing other than coming back to right now, right here, right now. Okay. Nothing else but right here, right now. Anything else is sandalwood. You know. So coming back to that problem, if I again ask that question, what's your problem? From an ordinary dualistic point of view, from an ordinary point of view that is viewed through time and space, as in past and future, we can list many, many problems. But when we truly cut down the sandalwood in our practice, in our meditation, there are no problems. There are actually no problems. All problems are in the future or from the past. All of our problems, and that is not there. I mean, you've heard me say that many times, but I don't think you can say it often enough. It is just incredible. There are actually no problems. So you can have the biggest problem in the world, but if we say, really, what exists, like getting rid of that metaverse, that bullshit world in our head, you know, what really does exist is only right now, not in 2 minutes, right now, what is the problem? You might say, oh, I've got a sore leg right now. Okay, so there's some pain there. You know, sore leg is already, that's already a conceptual thing. But right now, there is actually, you know, no problem. Our problems are all based in the future or in the past. That's a big one to really get. So and of course, out of that comes when we seek happiness or when we are seeking any type of fulfillment, we are seeking that in the future. Seeking in itself, that notion of seeking. If we're unsatisfied, there is already a notion of seeking something else, of not being right here because we are not concentrating on whatever it is we are doing. When we are unsatisfied, we are already with our head either in the past or in the future again. So when you look at right now, really when you look at right now and you hone down your concentration to what is happening right now, there is just this, whatever that is, your breath in your meditation, or the sensation of your fingers on your car, or just pain, or there's just this. And that is so narrow, that justice, that is so contained, does not have any problems. Keep that in mind. And of course, the koan points to that. Then it says, as of old, early spring is still chilly. As of old, early spring is still chilly. So if I go back to that, pass through the jungle of thorns, chop down the forest of sandalwood, and wait till the year comes to an end. As of old, early spring is still chilly. So the fact always remains the fact. Regardless of the problem of climate change, as of old, early spring is still hot in Brisbane, might be chilly in Japan or in China, but early spring is still hot. You know, it's such a simple sentiment. It's such a simple sentiment. As of old, nothing changes. Nothing changes. It always is as of old. And yet, in our metaverse or in our bullshit world or in our conceptual world, you know, we see all this change. We have all this worry. We've got all the problems of the world that are just thundering down on us. So the fact never changes. Cold, hot, rich, poor, all of that. Then it says, where is the Dharma body of the Buddha at all? So here's the challenge of that introduction. Where is the Dharma body? And of course, it points to the koan. Now look at the koan. In the koan, it tells you where it is. Where is the Dharma body of the Buddha at all? Okay. Some people interpret that sort of before awakening, after awakening, but it doesn't really matter. Where is the Dharma body? Even the word Dharma body is already very conceptual. Where is the Dharma body at all? You know? Do we find the Dharma body in the Pali canon and the Tibetan canon and the Chinese canon? Is the Dharma, where is it? Where is it what we are actually seeking? Where is the Dharma body at all? And here again, that question, where? Where is it? Is like, it also relates to, if I'm looking for it, I want it. If I'm looking for it, then where is it? I want to have it. It presupposes already an I. Where is it? It already presupposes a something. There's already a split there. And that's the difference between becoming something and being. Where is the Dharma body at all? If I want to look for mu, or if I want to look for the Dharma body, there's the danger here, because I will be continuously trapped in becoming something other than I am already. And again, you heard me say that many times before. So becoming is, you know, from that world, becoming is, it's not possible, you know. And the difference of becoming and being really is something that we need to look at. So this whole thing again points to what is being. If we look at our practice is nothing other than letting go. What are we letting go of? Becoming. We are letting go of becoming anything. What do I want to become? I want to become a Buddha. I want to become enlightened. I want to become a better me. that is actually stopping us from being. And so our coming back to our practice just letting it be, it arises. If I get to that point of just being, it automatically arises. And the Koan goes on to talk a little bit about that a little bit further on in the verse as well. So that's really important to, I feel, very important to look at. So from the beginning, when we look at being, being is from the beginning and to the end. Becoming is like there is already a future. Becoming, there's a stop there somewhere that I haven't gotten to. You know, there's a difference there. The other one to look at, the other part to, or the other aspect to look at in this, when we look at becoming and being, is identity again. When we look at our identity is so caught up in becoming. You know, as we're so caught up in the past. When I look at my identity as in my ordinary identity, you know, who am I? It's made up of, as I say in the introductory lecture, of all the things I have achieved, or all the things that were done to me, or all the things that I have grown up with, the culture, all of that. All of that falls into that becoming. And then whatever I am becoming when I grow up, when after uni, after I've had Kensho, whatever I'm, all is entitled, all is somehow connected to that. When we look at being, just being, identity through looking at identity through being is completely free. You know, if I can see who I am by bypassing that identity of the past and the future, if you like, if I can see who I am through the lens of being, man, my problems are gone. You know, even if I had a bad childhood, look at Devadatta, even him trying to kill the Buddha, if it's just being, there's no hell. There is no hell. So that's that. And again, that our practice is about accessing just being. Letting go is all about accessing just being. Being versus becoming. Like that. So where is the Dharma body of the Buddha at all? That question is all, it's when I ask that question, where is it? I am already trapped in that, you know, that identity of past and future. Okay, then we get to the very important question: where is the Dharma body of the Buddha at all? Is how the introduction ends. Then we get to the case. So Sagan's price of rice. Sagan was, by the way, he lived in 660 to 740. He was a student of Hui Neng, the sixth patriarch. He only had he had more than one student, but he only had one successor. But from him actually came three schools: Soto, Rinzai, and Hogen. Came through that school of Sagan. It's a very important master. His contemporary was Nanyue, the one that polished the bricks. You may remember me talking about that in another koan. So a very important master from that perspective. Without him, we wouldn't be sitting here. It's coming back to that dependent origination. So again, a monk asked Sagan, what is the essence of Buddha Dharma? Oh, there we go. What is it? So before we had, where is it after all? Now all of a sudden this monk asked Sagan, what is it? Okay. So what is the essence of the Buddha Dharma? In many ways you heard me say that a few times too in relation to the Mu Koan. That question, what is Mu? What is the essence of the Buddha Dharma? It's all the same question. You know, we might not necessarily frame it that way when we're children, but actually we're asking that question all the time. We just frame it differently. You know, where's mum? Where's dad? You know, we're continuously looking for whatever it is. We're continuously somehow that's what I feel. We're gravitating towards wanting to find salvation. You know, somehow we want to find peace. We want to find it. And one might say, what is happiness? What is my well-being? What is, you know, and of course we then look at it in all sorts of different ways. So that's the where is it? Is it in wealth? In health? You know, what is it? Impressive. What is it? And where is it? Many, many ways of asking that question. But honing it down to really, you know, what is it actually that everyone is looking for? Doesn't matter what religion is just one lens, but of course we're looking at it through so many different lenses, you know. And of course, even within religion, there are many, many lenses as well. So very important question. Where is it? What is it? Okay. So that is what he is asking, you know. So in many ways, you could say it's, whether we know it or not, it's our life's quest to be happy, to be peaceful. All of this sort of thing comes into it. And what's his answer? So Sagan says, what is the price of rice in Rorio? What sort of an answer is that? What is the price of rice in Rorio? That's the answer. Okay. What sort of an answer is that? And of course, that is the challenge of this koan. Can you see what is the price of Rorio? What is the price of rice in Rorio? Of course, the price of rice in Rorio, we might say, those days it was 50 cents per kilo. You know, if I say, what's the price of rice at Woolies? To what degree can I say that that is the complete answer of all of our questions? Just like Mo. What is the price of rice of Rorio? There is no beginning and no end. What is the price of rice of Rorio? That is what we need to discover for ourselves. That question contains absolutely everything. So, of course, not easy to see that. But that is what we must work towards and strive towards seeing. What is the price of rice in Rorio? It's not $5. $5 is $5. What is the price of rice in Rorio? That is the question. The only thing I could add to that is that it comes back to right now. Everything comes back to right now. So at that moment, what is it? What's the price of rice in Rorio? Everything else but right now is metaverse, bullshit world, if you like. What's the price of Rorio? What's the price of rice in Rorio? That's what we need to discover for ourselves. What that is. Okay, then we come to the verse. The reign of great peace knows no form. Beautiful. The reign of great peace knows no form. So he's asking, what is the Buddha Dharma? Of course, once we found that, we've got great peace, don't we? So you think, anyway. And he said, the price of rice, what's the price of rice in Rorio? And here it actually gives you, it says, the reign of great peace, in other words, once we discovered what that is, has no form. It's got nothing to do with form. The reign of great peace has no form. It reminded me of, even though there's a story relating to that, but it reminds me of the Brahma Viharas, of joy. Peace and joy, I think, are very much related. Again, when I let go to the point where I am fully present, which I get obviously through concentration and meditation or mindfulness, whatever word you want to use, if I let completely go, I cannot help but for joy to arise or peace to arise. You know, it's got no form. I cannot manufacture it. I mean, I can say I get a new car and I'm joyful because I've got a new car, but that is not the joy that is not the joy that we're talking about here. It's not that small joy. It is this deep joy, or this deep peace, you know. And so the reign of great peace knows no form. It actually refers to when you look at some teishas on this, it refers to some old emperors Shun and Gyo, who were canvassing their population to see if the people were happy, and the story goes that they send out emissaries and asked governors of the various districts to tell them whether the people were happy. It's a little bit like today, Morrison trying to find out if he's still popular or not. I mean, today we have polls that in many ways we've got social media, but in those days, in ancient China, you know, he relied on other people to tell them. And they couldn't tell him. They couldn't tell him whether the people were joyful or not, you know. So that's what it says, the reign of great peace, you know, some ruler that reigns of great peace has no form. You can't really find out. Same with Morrison, or he can't find out whether he's going to be reelected, no matter how many polls whether the people are happy or not. No matter how many polls they do, they always get it wrong one way. So it's a little bit like that. So again, it comes back to being versus becoming. The reign of great peace. Being versus becoming. That if we enter that world of being, you know, joy arises. Rather than becoming is, I haven't got it. There is no peace because I'm looking for it. You know, there's a difference here again. The atmosphere of the rugged old man is supremely pristine. So this, the atmosphere of the rugged old man, that refers to Sagan. You know, what the question of the koan, what is the essence of Buddha Dharma? You know, his answer, what is the price of rice in Roryo? And he's saying that the atmosphere of the rugged old man is pristine. That answer just nails it. He is just so in tune with it. That's what this is referring to. There is nothing but singing and drinking in the village festival. There is nothing but singing and drinking in the village festival. Again, here, you know, you could say that the village festival is our life. There's nothing. To what degree can I say there's nothing but singing and drinking in the village festival? To what degree does joy and singing and drinking, does that arise in our life? Again, it's a question I think that we need to answer ourselves, especially once we've had a Kensho experience. To what degree am I embodying? One thing to have a Kensho experience, but to what degree am I joyful, really joyful? You know, to what degree am I embodying all of this? You know, that's what this. That's the way I read it. Read this sentence there. How could they be aware of the virtues of Shun and the goodwill of Gyo? So that relates to the rulers that I talked about before. So that's a little bit obscure unless we know that story where the rulers were very concerned about their people. They were sort of, if you like, almost sage rulers, and they wanted to make sure that the people were happy. And so that's why they sent out those emissaries to find out how could they be aware of the virtues of Shun and the goodwill of Gyo. So that's what that that relates to. Okay, it's the end of the Tay Show. So I just wanted to, how much time have we got? I just wanted to just talk a little bit about a Thich Nhat Hanh who passed away yesterday. And I might just, it's a few pages long, but I think it might be worthwhile just reading out his biography a little bit, so that we should all know really who he is and what he's done. So if you bear with me, I'll read that out, if that's okay. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk and founder of the Engaged Buddhism movement, died today in his home country of Vietnam. He was 95. By the way, he termed the expression engaged Buddhism. That was very radical in those days, because Buddhism was, they did not engage, and it was apolitical in many ways. And so he really brought engaged Buddhism to the attention of everyone, and that was his term, engaged Buddhism. One of the great Buddhist teachers of our time, Thich Nhat Hanh, died today at Tu Hue Pagoda in Vietnam, the Buddhist temple where he was ordained at age 16. Following his stroke in 2014, he had expressed the desire to return to his homeland, and in October 2018 moved back to his home temple. There he spent the last years of his life surrounded by his close disciples and students. The International Plum Village has released a statement about Thich Nhat Hanh's passing. And it goes like this. International Plum Village Community of Engaged Buddhism announces that our beloved teacher Thich Nhat Hanh has passed away peacefully at Tu Hue Temple in Hue, Vietnam at 0 hours on the 22nd of January 2022 at the age of 95. We invite our global spiritual family to take a few moments to be still, to come back to our mindful breathing as we together hold Thay, he was known as Thay, that sort of is, everyone knew him as Thay, in our hearts in peace and loving gratitude for all he has offered the world. More official news will be coming shortly. Thich Nhat Hanh, affectionately referred to as Thay by his students, has often been referred to as the father of mindfulness. In his 95 years, he made a global impact as a teacher, author, activist, and the founder of the Engaged Buddhism movement. His simple yet deeply profound teachings led countless people towards a life of mindfulness, joy, and peace. Thich Nhat Hanh suffered a brain hemorrhage in November 2014 and spent 4.5 months at a stroke rehabilitation clinic at Bordeaux University Hospital. He returned to Plum Village in France, where his health made remarkable progress, and he was able to enjoy being out in nature, enjoying the blossoms, listening to the birds, and resting at the foot of a tree. In 2016, 2 months after his 90th birthday, Thich Nhat Hanh expressed a wish to travel to Thailand, to be closer to his homeland in Vietnam. He spent nearly 2 years at Thai Plum Village there, and in October 2018, Thich Nhat Hanh traveled to Vietnam to spend the remainder of his days at his root temple. Thich Nhat Hanh was born Nguyen Xuan Bao in Hue, Vietnam, in October of 1926. Interested in Buddhism from an early age, he entered the monastery at Tu Hue Temple in Vietnam at age 16. There he worked with his primary teacher, Zen master Than Quy Chan. In 1951, Nhat Hanh was ordained as a monk after receiving training in Vietnamese Mahayana and Tien Buddhist tradition. It was then that he received the name Thich Nhat Hanh. So that's his spiritual name. As Lindsay Kite reported for Lion's Roar is a Buddhist magazine, in The Life of Thich Nhat Hanh, Nathan was sent for training as a Buddhist at a Buddhist academy, but was dissatisfied with the curriculum, wanting to study more modern subjects. He left for the University of Saigon, where he could study world literature, philosophy, psychology, and science, in addition to Buddhism. He went on to begin his activist work, founding La Boa Press and the Van Han Buddhist University in Saigon. He also founded the School of Youth for Social Service, a neutral corps for Buddhist peace workers who established schools, built healthcare clinics, and rebuilt villages in rural areas. Nathan accepted a fellowship to study comparative religion at Princeton University in 1960 and was subsequently appointed a lecturer in Buddhism at Columbia University. He had become fluent in English, Japanese, Chinese, Sanskrit, Pali, and English. In 1963, a US-backed military coup had overthrown the Diem regime, and Nathan returned to Vietnam to continue initiating nonviolent peace efforts. He submitted a peace proposal to the United Buddhist Church, UBC, calling for a cessation of hostilities, the establishment of a Buddhist institute for the country's leaders, and the creation of a center to promote nonviolent social change. The founding of the Engaged Buddhism Movement was his response to the Vietnam War. Nathan's mission was to engage with the suffering caused by war and injustice and to create a new strain of Buddhism that could save his country. In the formative years of the Engaged Buddhist Movement, Nathan met Cao Ngoc Phuong, who would later become Sister Chan Kong. She hoped to encourage activism for the poor in the Buddhist community and worked closely with Thich Nhat Hanh to do so. She remained his closest disciple and collaborator for the remainder of his life. In 1966, Thich Nhat Hanh returned to the US to lead a symposium at Cornell University on Vietnam Buddhism. There he met Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and asked King to denounce the Vietnam War. Dr. King granted the request the following year with a speech questioning America's involvement in the war. Soon after, King nominated Thich Nhat Hanh for the Nobel Peace Prize. "I do not personally know of anyone more worthy of the prize than this gentle monk from Vietnam. His ideas for peace, if applied, would build a monument to ecumenism, the world brotherhood to humanity," he wrote. In June of that year, Thich Nhat Hanh presented a peace proposal in Washington urging Americans to stop bombing Vietnam, emphasizing that he and his followers favored neither side of the war and wanted only peace. In response, Thich Nhat Hanh was exiled from Vietnam. He was granted asylum in France, where he became chair of the Vietnamese Buddhist Peace Delegation. Thich Nhat Hanh was the head of the Order of Interbeing. You may have heard of that, Interbeing. It is also quite strong here in Australia. A monastic and lay group that he founded in 1966. In 1969, he also founded the Unified Buddhist Church and later in 1975 formed the Sweet Potatoes Meditation Center, southeast of Paris, France. As the center grew in popularity, Thich Nhat Hanh and Sister Chan Kong founded Plum Village, a Vihara Buddhist monastery and Zen center in the south of France in 1982. In 1987, he founded Parallax Press in California, which publishes his writings in English. He established Deer Park Monastery in Southern California, his first monastery in America, in the year 2000. Since then, many Dharma centers across the U.S., serving tens of thousands of lay students, have been established as part of the Order of Interbeing. After negotiations, the Vietnam government allowed Nathan, now a well-known Buddhist teacher, to return to Vietnam for a visit in 2005. He was able to teach, publish 4 books in Vietnamese, travel the country, and visit his root temple. Although his first trip home stirred controversy, Nathan was allowed to return again in 2007. to support new monastics in his order, organizing chanting ceremonies to heal wounds from the Vietnam War and lead retreats for groups of up to 10,000 people. We gauge the greatness of spiritual teachers by the depth, breadth, and impact of their teachings, and by the examples their lives set for us. By all these measures, Thich Nhat Hanh is one of the leading spiritual masters of our age, writes Lion Roar's editor-in-chief, Melvin McLeod, in his introduction to The Pocket Thich Nhat Hanh. In his lifetime, Thich Nhat Hanh authored more than 100 books, which have been translated into 35 languages, on a vast range of subjects, from simple teachings on mindfulness to children books, poetry, and scholarly essays on Zen practice. His most recent book, Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet, was published by HarperCollins in 21. His community consists of more than 600 monastics worldwide, and there now exists more than 1,000 practice centers, practice communities attended by his dedicated Sangha across North America and Europe. It is estimated that Thich Nhat Hanh created over 10,000 works of calligraphy in his life, each sharing unique simple messages. Breathe, you're alive. Happiness is here and now. Present moment, wonderful moment, so forth. In a newsletter to the community, Plum Village shared that starting Saturday, January 22, the global community is invited to come together online to commemorate Thich Nhat Hanh's life and legacy. So you can go onto their website if anyone wanted to do that. The one thing that in his book was also published in this little biography here, there's something that he wrote, and I've put that on that sheet down there. I just wanted to read this out, which, I mean, this is just a little bit about his life. And by the way, before we go to that, Thich Nhat Hanh's Zen is a different Zen in one way to ours. When I say that, of course it's all Zen, but his Zen is very much a Zen of, if you like, of engagement. You would almost say like, and when we read his little piece that he wrote there about his upcoming death, you will get what I mean. You know, he had a very, very deep sense of what all of this and what we are talking about is all about. But he never taught that as such. He taught through actions. His teaching is very much a teaching of engagement. You know, very simple teachings, very powerful teachings. And of course he was a monastic. His whole life was based on somehow on activism, but a gentle activism, on showing up in all sorts of difficult situations, and through his activism and through his engagement, showing by way of example. That is how he taught Zen. And very impressive what he has done. But it has a different flavor to our type of Zen, I must say. But I won't go into the differences or that. That's really not that important. But just what he wrote is very interesting. He wrote down, this is all about addressing his inevitable death. Okay, that's addressing his inevitable death. He wrote down, this body of mine will disintegrate. This body of mine will disintegrate. But my actions will continue me. My actions will continue me. If you think I'm only this body, then you have not truly seen me. That's a wonderful statement. If you think I am only this body, then you have not truly seen me. And quite often, coming back to this, you know, when we look at people, what we are seeing is their, you know, their identity based on their past or what they put or what we think it is through our own little world. We are seeing people not who they really truly are. And that's what he's saying. If you really, if you think I'm only this body or only my past, you have not seen me at all. And in many ways, you know, where is the Dharma body at all? Is seeing Thich Nhat Hanh, seeing who he really is, seeing who I really am. You know, that's what he's referring to here. If you think I'm only this body, then you have not truly seen me. When you look at my friends, you see my continuation. When you see someone walking with mindfulness and compassion, you know he is my continuation. I don't see why we have to say, I will die. Because I can already see myself in you, in other people, and in future generations. And that, to me, that is his engagement. That is his purpose in life. Is his purpose is his, the future. He sees himself in everything. Continuation is continuing. I mean, everything is continuing all the time. There is no end to Thich Nhat Hanh. There is no end to David. There is no end to Pat or Margaret or Sheila. Even when the cloud is not there, it continues as snow or rain. It is impossible for the cloud to die. It can become rain or ice, but it cannot become nothing. The cloud does not need to have a soul in order to continue. There's no beginning and no end. I will never die, he wrote. There will be a dissolution of this body, but that does not mean my death. I will continue always.